This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, Happy New Year. We're allowed to say that for a day or so?
Well, it's almost February.
I know.
I don't know if you can say Happy New Year after like mid-January, but that's sort of a I don't know if you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm, but Larry David has rules about that.
And is it mid-January?
I don't remember. It's you only get like a week after any holiday where you can still congratulate somebody or say Happy Holidays. After that, he gets very angry with you for saying that. But I'll let it pass on this one.
Thanks.
So I'll be seeing you in tomorrow, right?
Tomorrow. I'm looking forward to it.
Tomorrow in Miami?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I'm a little bit apprehensive. We've got our inner circle meeting, and it's going to be the first time I'm going as a member, which I'm super excited about. But I'm also feeling like a fish out of water.
Well, you don't have to do your speech until the summer.
That's true. But I have a feeling everybody's going to remind me of that, too.
They'll be ribbing you about it. Yeah. Yeah, so dress code, you know, I recommend a hoodie, sweatshirt, and cargo shorts.
Oh, perfect. So you're going to be helpful about this. I really appreciate that.
People, the new admittees, like, generally come in costume, too. It's customary to dress up as Taylor Swift.
Okay. So I'll just bring mine.
Just do that, and you'll fit right in. Everyone will be really happy about it, and excited to see you.
It's good. I don't even have to shop then. That's perfect.
Yeah. You could wear that Bills onesie.
That I might do, depending on the weather.
Yeah. So we're really excited today to welcome Katie Bertram to the podcast. Katie is a trial lawyer out of Washington, D.C., and has had many great verdicts, including one that came down just last week. So she still has that glazed over. I haven't recovered all of my sleep yet from my trial look about her. But welcome, Katie, and thanks for doing this so soon after your trial.
Oh, thank you. I'm just so delighted to be here on the podcast with you guys. And I love your podcast. So thank you so much. And I am still trying to get my sea legs back. I find I love being in trial, but then when you're done, that you kind of crash with your, you need sleep, you need food, and it feels kind of mundane to have to answer emails and go back to work after all the excitement. But yeah, we're still super excited from our verdict last week.
So usually we start with kind of some bio and then move up to the present and talk about some of the milestone cases and verdicts. But actually in this case, I was thinking maybe we could go in the reverse order because this is so fresh. And I was reading an account that was circulated around about the case you just tried and the complexity of it and the theories that you've developed that really highlights the business incentives that go along with the practice of medicine and outpatient surgery centers and taps into your experience doing risk management in the medical field. But can we start there? Can you tell us about that case and how you put it together and what it was all about and how you got that great result?
Yes, I think that this is an area, unfortunately, for us all to focus on in the future because medicine is becoming less of a profession and more of a business. And there's a lot of equity firms that are investing in these ambulatory surgery centers, which are surgery centers outside of the hospital. And there's lots of good data as to why you might go to a surgery center, less infection rate, things like that. But there's also a lot of inherent conflict and safety issues in ambulatory surgery centers. And many of them are owned either by the physicians or by an equity group. And what we're finding is there's an inherent conflict because a surgeon will refer a patient to a surgery center or to, in our case, the case we just tried, his own vascular surgery center, which was a 27,000 foot building where he was the sole surgeon. So what happens is you lose those checks and balances that you would have in a hospital. And so when I was a risk manager at Georgetown, I can tell you that there's things called compliance officers. There's utilization review officers. And what they do is they have checks and balances to make sure surgeries are necessary, surgeries are being done appropriately, they're being billed appropriately. Those are the kinds of things you lose when someone does it in their own office, right? Because there's no check. There's nobody checking to see if the surgery was necessary, if it was even done, which was an issue in our case, and if the billing is appropriate or if the anesthesia is safe. So these are things that I think we're seeing more and more. And it's particularly true in certain specialties. And that was true here. So for vascular surgery.
What was the surgery involved in your case?
So he did three surgeries on her. All three were unnecessary. Two were called arthrectomies, which means he goes in and he scrapes out the lining of her arteries in her legs. And those were both unnecessary. And then the third one he did on her veins in her leg. And it's called a venous ablation. People might have heard of it. There are vein clinics all over. And what you do is you go in with a heat device, a radio frequency device, and you literally melt the vein closed. And then your body uses collateral veins to make it better. And that way you're supposed to get rid of the problems you're having with circulation. The issue is when the doctor does it in his office, he gets to double bill. He bills as a surgeon and he bills as for the facility. So he makes quite a bit of money. And so here he billed for the artery surgeries $25,000 for each surgery, which is outrageous. And he was making, we knew from the data, this is something people can get. There's government data, CMS has data for each surgeon as to what they bill each year for each procedure. In the 3-year period where he cared for our client, he was paid $18 million.
Holy cow.
Just for his Medicare patients. One guy.
Wow.
One of the top billers in the country. And that's how the government looks to find fraud, is looking at those top billers to see if it's really medically necessary. And what's so sad is the State Board of Medicine did an investigation on him at the same time period and pulled 11 of his files just randomly and had two board certified independent vascular surgeons review his files. And they found 10 out of 11 were medically unnecessary and were a breach of the standard of care. So what do you think happened? What would happen to a physician who was doing that? All they did was suspend him and say he could practice if he was supervised. So what was really frustrating in our case, that was during the time period when our client was injured. So we added a fraud count to our case once we realized our experts said the same thing happened to our client, who was a nurse. He told her she needed these surgeries and she didn't even know that it was fraud.
Who was supervising him?
No one is supervising him. That was the other thing. You'll see in the article that his wife started working at the facility. And she indicated in her licensing work for Virginia that she was working there 20% of the time, but he would never tell us if someone was supervising him and we could never get that data. So we're not sure what he was actually doing, but he signed off on her surgeries. And there was no indication of who was in the room with him when doing this sedation, the IV sedation. So it's pretty scary stuff. And I think what was really frustrating and what my co-counsel and I are going to work to change is the Maryland law, because those were final decisions by the Board of Medicine as to what he was doing wrong in the pattern and practice. And they also found that he was a danger to the public. And this is not our judge's fault, but there's a statute in Maryland that says none of that can come into evidence, either in a civil case or a criminal case. And while I understand if it was just allegations, it shouldn't come in, there should be some leeway to allow judges to decide what's relevant and what should come into evidence. And right now in Maryland, it really protects the doctor that's doing unsafe things. And so we're going to work very hard to change that law. And we're thankful that our client was brave and willing to go through this lawsuit to do it.
How much of that, what you just told us, were you able to get in at trial? Were you able to get in the amount that he was paid?
Zero. The judge would not let me use the CMS data to show how much you made, the $18 million, because we need to show pattern and practice for fraud, and he wouldn't let us do it. And we couldn't get in anything about his license or the findings from the other patients. And obviously, we can't get those records, right? No one would allow us to get those records because that would be a violation of those patients' privacy.
What was the reason for not allowing the CMS evidence of how much he was paid?
The judge said he didn't think that that was relevant.
Wow, it made my eyes pop right when I heard
it. Yeah, I mean, I argued pretty hard. You can imagine that that showed pattern and incentive and everything else. The judge was like, I just don't see it. Now, it's one of those things where my co-counsel reminded me that, you know, Katie, when they make those rulings, we're probably winning. Just relax. So, but I really felt like that should come in. And he might have let it in the punitive damages phase if we got that far, but he wasn't letting it in for just regular civil fraud.
So what was the doctor's defense to all of this? What did he say when he took the stand?
He said that he believed that she had the conditions that he was treating her for, and in good faith, in, you know, using his judgment, he thought that she needed those procedures. What was really nice and what really helped is she went to an independent vascular surgeon after she had the nerve injury in her leg. And he was brave enough to write in the record that the surgeries weren't indicated and to tell her she didn't need any more surgery on her other leg. So that we did get to use, and that was extremely helpful. And the doctor changed all his records once I requested the records. 6 days later, he changed all his notes. And so I'm kind of an audit trail nut. So we got the audit trail and we could prove all of that. And so he continued to say, even at trial, when I cross-examined him, that he just did it to make it more accurate. But it was not done well. And so it was actually not very accurate. So we had quite a good time. And then we entered into evidence a second version of the record with all the yellow highlights of what he changed. So it was pretty fun.
Unbelievable.
This is a kind of a doctor death situation.
Yes. And he has injured. He's facing, I think, 2 or 3 more trials coming up. And those lawyers came to watch. In one case, I know it's death. And in one case, I believe it's loss of a limb. So they're very serious risks for doing these procedures. And while the outcomes are generally good, he's putting people at risk so that he can profit. And that was really the theme of our case, that he was put profits over patient safety.
Back to the business side of these outpatient surgery centers, I've seen these cases myself. And what are you finding in terms of the ownership structure of this one? Was this a private equity ownership, or did he own it himself?
100% Dr. Dormu. So he owned the whole thing and had no other surgeons operating, at least at the time our client was operated on. His wife was listed on the payroll, but we don't have any information.
And how are they capitalized and insured?
So he was not insured. That's the other thing that's interesting. So in Maryland, the doctors are not required to have insurance. And so again, the only way to make doctors and surgeons specifically get insurance in Maryland is they're required to if they practice at a hospital, because the hospital requires it. But once he went into his own, you know, fox guarding the hen house, he didn't have to have insurance.
It sounds like he makes enough money to pay a verdict, at least up to a certain level, but there'll be limits to that if he's sued multiple times for people that have even more severe harms.
Right. That's why we were very grateful to be first. And one of the things we did do is when the jury came back with the verdict for medical negligence, informed consent, and fraud, they gave the 2.5 verdict. And so at that point, the judge said, all right, we're about to go into the punitive phase, and sent the jury back into the jury room just so we could talk about logistics. There's no Maryland case that has allowed punitives against a physician. So we were a little nervous in terms of an appeal. So we suggested to the defendant that they consider right there and then agreeing to enter full judgment against both the doctor and the surgeon for the full amount with no right of remittitor and no right to reduce it to the cap, because we have a cap as well, and no appeal. So they went and discussed it. And then on the record, the doctor agreed to that. So we think that's our best strategy in terms of being able to go ahead and collect, because fraud damages are not dischargeable. So we feel pretty strongly that we're going to be able to collect some of this for our client.
A really great result. And you're highlighting something that presents a systemic risk to many people. So that's probably saving others from the same fate as your client.
Yes. The other thing people can look at for ambulatory surgery cases where there is that inherent conflict, where the surgeons actually own the center, both in the federal guidelines, CMS guidelines, and in our state for Maryland guidelines, the surgeons are required to tell people up front and to get them to sign something in writing, okay? Because they're supposed to give them alternatives. So people can look out for that. And in another case we had with a gentleman that was left paralyzed, that's what we used. So the claim we added was breach of fiduciary duty. So that's something else for people to consider. You can add that claim. It's similar to fraud. And in general, that allows you to get into those issues if the patient steered only to the surgery center and not told other options and you feel that there was negligence. So it's another good opportunity. And in my other case, we were able to settle it, but the ambulatory surgery center did have to pay significant money up above the insurance.
What is the law that requires that they disclose that?
So the CMS, so it's the Medicare guidelines, and I believe it's the patient's rights guideline. And off the top of my head, I believe it's 416.5 that requires that they tell the patient in writing.
I'm very interested in this because I have a case quite similar to it where my client was paralyzed from a radio frequency ablation procedure designed to address pain in his cervical spine. And he had gone to this pain management clinic. They started out with lumbar ablations and then kind of worked their way up. But there's certain industry guidelines about what is required for those procedures to be medically indicated. And I don't want to get into the boring details of it, but in our case, we have good evidence that the procedure that they did that paralyzed him was not even medically indicated. And just like your case, they were billing extraordinary amounts of money for every procedure.
Yeah.
Every procedure required not just the final procedure, but two rounds of therapeutic diagnostic procedures, each of which was billed at very, very high levels. So we've gone through the discovery and obtained all the billing. But interestingly, when I deposed the owner of the facility who owns it outright, like in your case, he claimed not to know what they charged for procedures. He didn't know what the sources of his revenue were. For example, whether they made money predominantly on procedures versus office visits. You know, an office visit is like $150 for a 30-minute visit. A procedure is like $12,000 for 15 minutes of the surgeon's time. But he claimed not to know that. And we're trying to figure out how to tie it all together so that when we get to court, we can show the incentive structure and the business model similar to in your case.
So in most of those places, they have frequent meetings for the owner or the business people where they talk about volume. I would be very surprised if they don't have meetings where they talk about volume and collectibles. And that's how, in the other case, we got to the incentives, because they had no discussion about patient safety. And the number one agenda every month on the agenda was profitability and collections. So there's definitely, I think, ways to look at that. And they do keep that data. So they keep it by code. So I'm happy offline to help you if you need
help
figuring out how to get to that. But there's definitely if you look at the coding, a lot of times they upcode it too. So here, they would do a diagnostic procedure. He should be looking at just the arteries in her legs, right? But instead, he did what our vascular surgeon called a drive-by. So he also shot dye into her kidneys and looked at her kidneys, because you can bill an extra $600 when you're going by in the artery. So there's all sorts of things in the coding that you can look at and get help with. And those are things, again, that would be a check and a balance. If you were in a hospital, they would nail you for doing that, right? Because they're afraid of the fraud charges. So there's definitely ways that checks and balances are not being used in the setting. And if they're saying they don't check it, we did in another case, we filed a negligent supervision claim, which we then got insurance under their kind of human resources policy for that type of negligence. So sometimes you can end around that way, because they have a duty to check to see what's being done and if it's medically necessary. They can't just allow surgeons to do whatever they want. So there's a lot of ways around, I think, of crafting it so that you can get coverage and get those types of claims in.
Is there, for those drive-by procedures, the dye in the kidney, does the doctor even get consent for that? I mean, is it a battery?
That's a very good question. He didn't in this case. It wasn't on the consent form, and it was in the operative note. And at the time I brought it up in opening, I heard this defendant was rather loud at the defense table. I heard him say to the defense counsel, "That's a mistake. I didn't do it. It shouldn't have been on there." And then when I said it, and then my next sentence was, "And he did it twice," because he did it on the other side too, both kidneys twice. And then he shut up. So then when he got on the stand, I was like, "What's he going to say?" And then he just tried to say it was necessary, because I think he realized he was going to get bashed either way.
And in the audit trail, he originally had it as four times, but he deleted two of them, not the other two.
Whatever. He put in a lot of symptoms, yeah, when he went back in, but he didn't do it. He had somebody else do it. It was a very unique case, I will say. But I'm happy that he's now suspended and doesn't have a license. And I want there to be justice for Alice. And I think she was thrilled when the jury came back and really validated what happened, because as a nurse, she's a teacher and she teaches nursing, and she had really lost her passion for it because of this episode. And I want her to get that back so she can keep teaching the nurses for the future with the passion that she had, because she felt duped and she was blaming herself, and that should never be the case.
Are you able to testify before the Maryland Medical Board to educate them on ways of...
We're going to try to do that before the Maryland Board, but also the Maryland Legislature, to try to change the law, because I think that's the most important thing. It is admissible in some other jurisdictions, but Maryland has this unusual statute. So my co-counsel and I are going to work hard with our client to make that change, because it's really makes no sense for the taxpayers to pay for the Board of Medicine to do these kinds of investigations, for the results to be public in the sense that they're on the website, but then to it not be admissible when you're going after the very wrongdoer in the exact same situation. So I'm not saying it should be automatically admissible, but I think you've got to give judges the leeway to admit it when it's relevant, and just makes no sense the other way.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. Can we go back to your time working as a risk manager for Georgetown Hospital?
Sure.
Because as a plaintiff lawyer and doing mostly medical cases, I'm very accustomed to seeing risk managers. They're usually that person that's on the box in your Zoom deposition in the far, right-hand corner, just kind of skulks there and watches things with a critical eye. And then later on, you made judicial settlement conference or mediation. And I know that they're in that role, you're seeing a lot of things and probably know the inside stories that we never hear as the plaintiff's lawyers, where the bodies are buried, so to speak, that we aren't successful at foraging out or uncovering. But if we only knew what you had known, that would have changed things, or there's things you're worried about. So can you just kind of give us an insight into what that was like and what did you learn in that role that has helped inform your career after moving on to do plaintiff's work?
So it was both the most stressful and the most rewarding job I had until I became a plaintiff's lawyer, because...
You were already a lawyer at that point, right?
Yes, yes, I did. Before that, I was a defense lawyer and I defended Georgetown. So that was my client. And it was an interesting story, but I had two little kids and I was running that practice group at my law firm, and my husband had a crazy political job. And I was feeling like somebody needed to get off the merry-go-round to actually parent our children. We had like a nanny, we had someone drop off dry cleaning, the clothes got, you know, someone mowed the lawn.
I think you're describing Rahul's life there.
It was crazy. And my husband could not leave his job. So I was thinking about, what the heck am I going to do? Like, I have my whole life outsourced. This is not right. And then one day I got a call from Georgetown and they had had a Sentinel event. And they're like, can you come over and help us? Because we don't have anybody in this position. And I went over there and it was just one of the most amazing days of my life. And they then offered me the job. So I did it. And I think that I was very lucky, because that the group that owns that hospital really is all about patient safety. And so we were able to do a lot of things that I don't think most risk managers are able to do. Because I was a lawyer and had tried a lot of cases, I got a lot more respect and credibility, I think, than some risk managers really have at their institutions. So we were able to affect a lot of change and to work with the chairs of the department and the nursing staff to really make big changes. And so it was quite rewarding and it was quite wonderful to be able to teach the residents and the doctors too. So I do treasure that. I think it was a good experience for me, but I understand what you're saying. I don't think most risk managers have that power or that ability. And so they're stuck in a position where maybe they just keep seeing the same errors over and over again. But when we had like a near miss, we would call it, when something almost bad happened and a doctor or a nurse would tell us, we would dive in and try to analyze it and figure it out and make sure it didn't happen again. And we thought of those as gifts. So I think I had a very good experience, but I'm pretty certain that's not true for most risk managers.
Did you learn things in doing that job that, as a plaintiff's lawyer, you recognized that when people were bringing cases, they weren't asking for the right information or weren't looking in the right places?
Right. So when I decided my kids were old enough that I just missed litigation, I love being in trial. Like, I love it more than anything. And so I think it's because I was an athlete. I just love being in that setting, that competitive setting. So the minute my kids were old enough to drive and do their own things, I was like, I'm going back. But I went back as a plaintiff's lawyer. So very different. And, you know, I think different lawyers are skilled at being on one side or the other. And for me, I want to weave the tapestry. I want to create the case and the themes and everything else. I don't like just trying to use a cannon to shoot a hole in something and try to sink the ship. I am much more built for this side. And you don't get any rewards on the other side by being creative. So I love it. And I think my background is extremely helpful because I know where the system failures are. I know what questions to ask. I know what policies they have. I know how to get to whatever the issue is I need. And in the $17 million verdict that we had in 2022, I knew what kind of policy they would have. So I'm able to ask for it and get to the right person and then get that 30B6 deposition done to show, you know, what should have been done. So it does give me an advantage just knowing how the hospital systems work. And again, you can apply that to what should be true in an ambulatory surgery center too.
Well, in an ambulatory surgery center, they may not even have a risk manager. So it's like shooting fish in a barrel for you, right? Just asking all the questions about risk management. They don't have an answer.
Exactly. We had an OB case like that where something went wrong, but it was in the office setting. And so we did a 30B6 of the owner and they had no risk management. They did no reviews on outcomes for their physicians or anything like that, or their education, their continuing education. I mean, it was outrageous. So I think you can really get to the bottom quickly. And that entity was owned by that. They were owned by a private equity group. And everything was focused on business generation. Nothing was focused on patient safety.
That verdict you were mentioning, is that the
Shanane Beatty
case versus Washington Hospital Center Corporation?
Yeah.
And that was a 2022 trial. Can you tell us a little bit about that case?
Sure. So the plaintiff was the sister of the deceased patient. The deceased patient had three children and she went in to the OB clinic because she had been bleeding. And the nurse practitioner that saw her did a cursory sonogram, but didn't really look at her ovaries or anything and told her to come back, did a pregnancy test. She was pregnant, told her to come back for some more blood work and sent her home, but didn't tell her about the risk of ectopic pregnancy. And so our client, that the mother, didn't realize that she should come back for this blood test and how important it was. So she was working mom with three little kids and she didn't come back by the lab to get her blood drawn again. So they called her and said, come on in, get your blood drawn. And what they didn't tell her is that the first labs had come back and that her hormone level for pregnancy was quite high, meaning something was going on. It wasn't a normal pregnancy, but they didn't tell her that. So she thought she just needed to confirm the pregnancy. Well, she had been pregnant three times before. She didn't think that was anything urgent. She was just going to wait to when she went back in to see the doctor the next time. And she died of an ectopic pregnancy several days later, not knowing that risk. So
wow.
The defendant didn't make an offer in the case because we're a state with contributory negligence. So if she's found 1% responsible, you lose. So that was their shtick throughout the trial. That was their theme. And so we filed a motion to have the judge strike that claim because what people need to use now is they need to ask the doctors and the nurses, were you using shared decision-making? Okay, that sounds like a goofy phrase, but it's extremely important because that's what doctors and nurses do now. They don't just tell you what to do, right? They interact with you, give you all the options for your treatment, the risks and benefits, and then you make a joint decision. Well, unless that's done, the patient really can't be contributory negligent because she didn't know she was at risk of death. She didn't know she was at risk of an ectopic pregnancy. So choosing to wait to come back for the blood test is not negligent if you don't know that it's going to make any difference in your outcome. And so we were able to successfully argue that and get the nurse practitioner at trial to say it should have been shared decision-making, or it was shared decision-making. I think that's really important. We've all of us that do MedMal run into that. 4 years later, they say, well, I can't remember what I said, but my habit and custom is to say, you know, and then they spurt out exactly what they're supposed to say, right? So the way we combat that is by getting them in deposition to admit that they do shared decision making. And so that way it's a very personalized, detailed discussion based on that particular patient's risks and alternatives and not just the spiel, right? Then the spiel doesn't really make sense because you can't say 3 years ago, that's what I said, when it has to be crafted for that particular patient. And so we were able to win that case, I think, because we made those arguments and the jury understood that no reasonable person, especially a mother of three, would blow off a lab test if she knew she could die. that was that case.
And the judge granted that motion and precluded them from
yes.
presenting the contributory negligence claim to the jury?
Yes. And so we won the case at trial, and then they appealed to the appellate court in DC, and it was argued. And then we resolved the case before the decision came out. We were very happy with the oral argument and felt like we were going to make great law in DC on that issue, but we'll have to do that next time.
That's pretty interesting. I can't imagine having to try these cases in a contributory negligence state like that, because the 1% requirement is so minimal for the defense to have to show that. And
it's
already hard enough when you don't have that rule.
Yeah. When I first started as a plaintiff's lawyer, we had some cases at our firm that were very, very challenging that they gave me when one of the partners left. And I think I lost 6 in a row for contrib. Like, it was brutal. I was really questioning my sanity and my ability, because I never lost a case as a defense lawyer, never. So a trial. So I really had to dig deep to come up with, there's got to be a way around this issue. There has to be. And that's kind of what I've come up with. And I feel like it's working really well. And I know some people don't like informed consent claims. They feel like they're just add-ons. But in the right cases with the right circumstances, I think they're very powerful. And if you do focus groups, which we're a little addicted to that too, jurors will tell you over and over again, it's my body, it's my right. And it's both the pro-choice jurors and the anti-vaxxers. It's both. They're all about, I get to choose what's put into my body. I get to choose what risks I want to take. And so it's an extremely powerful claim right now, I think.
So going back, just taking a step back, you touched on when you switched to becoming a plaintiff lawyer, contrib, 6 in a row. For all the listeners out there, how do you lose 6 in a row, keep getting up, and then learning from it, and then developing a way to frame the case to then have success? How do you pick yourself back up over and over again?
It was really hard. And I did question whether, I mean, I thought I was a good lawyer. And by about the 4th one, I was feeling pretty awful. But these clients, you know, I was a psych and social work major, and I love my clients way too much, I will say. So I felt like I needed to go in there and try to win for them. And I think it was maybe the 5th one where I went in and we didn't have a chance. And the risk manager, because I know all the risk managers, right? So the risk manager for GW Hospital, who watched the whole thing, said to me afterwards, she said, there was no way you could win that. But I'll tell you what, if you come in front of me on one that I think you're going to win, I'm not letting you try it. So I was like, all right, I'll just keep going. So that was really very nice of her. And it kind of kept me going. And then I started my own firm. So I had a lot more autonomy on how to theme a case and what to do and what cases to try. And I think also as you get older, at least for me, you figure out that you can really be who you are in trial. You don't have to try to be somebody else. So I think I also stopped trying to be like the men that I was practicing with and just started to be okay with me. So that I think also made a big difference, but it took me a while to do that, especially with the losses. So if I'm honest, I would say that. You had Scott Perry on. You can ask Scott Perry in that I was that $37 million case during the middle of case. I just went over to my purse and pulled out a quilting ruler because I'm a big quilter, to use it with a surgeon about millimeters. And I thought Scott Perry was going to fall out of his chair, but I am okay. Like, I am a quilter. Here's my ruler. Look, this is, and I think you just have to be who you are, and juries know that. And then they're able to trust you.
One of the things I've always felt in doing the medical cases is that it is a lot easier to defend the cases than to prosecute them on the plaintiff's side. Is that just an urban legend that we tell ourselves as plaintiff's lawyers to make ourselves feel better about losing? Or is that really true, having done it on both sides?
Oh, because I can call, like, if I'm defending Georgetown, right? If I'm defending the chair, which I got to do once, the chair of neurosurgery, I can call any expert in this country, right? I can get anybody on board to support. It's way different. And if you think about it, for a medical malpractice case, as opposed to an auto accident case, we're dealing with people that are already very sick, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't be in the hospital. So as a defense lawyer, you have all of that in your favor, right? For causation and for complications. And so it's way easier to defend these cases. That's why they can have 30, 40 cases that are active on their docket, right? Because they're just shooting holes. There's like three or four themes, same ones over and over again. So, you know, I think it's definitely harder on our side, especially if you're in a contrib state.
What about defending doctors? I guess they come in all shapes and sizes, but a lot of them who are getting deposed, do they take your feedback on how to testify well or poorly?
That's very variable depending on their personality and their background. Some of them realize that they're in your world now. Some of them do not. Right. And you can work with them. You know, we used to call it witness school. You can work with them for a long time. But when the pressure gets on, they're going to say whatever they're going to say. And they're not used to being questioned. Right. Because most of them are attendings. And so the way the medical model works, they don't get questioned. And so it's a very difficult situation for them to be in. And for the most part, I found they would listen to up to a point. But one of the most difficult things is you would try a case in DC with no cap and you'd win as a defense lawyer. And the doctor would be like, well, of course, I didn't do anything wrong. Wow.
Yeah. So that was lesson learned.
Of course you won.
So you said that one of the ways in which you found your own authentic voice and became the version of yourself that became more successful in your plaintiff's career was to try to not model yourself on the male lawyers that you were working with, but to find your own authentic, I guess, female voice. For other female lawyers maybe who are starting out and find themselves kind of in that setting, is there advice you would give that would help them kind of find that voice sooner and not have to take on a persona that they're not comfortable with?
Yeah, I think we're luckier now. I mean, I'm 60, so we're luckier now. And the young women that are coming up are luckier because there's a lot more role models and mentors that they can have now. I would read Randy McGinn's books and try to go to her talks. I would do what I could to see other really successful female lawyers. And I think that helped me quite a bit. But I would say to reach out and find someone that you can talk to. And there's a lot of, I know around here for each of our trial lawyer associations, we have a women's caucus. And I think that's another really good opportunity to talk to other women. We actually have an event tonight. Talk to other women and get feedback from other women. And I just didn't have as much of that. And I will say the lawyers that I worked with were spectacular and they always gave me great advice. But finding your own voice, at least for me, was really important. And it took me a while to do it. And I don't know if it's because I lost those cases and I questioned myself. I'm not sure. But, you know, I knew that I finally had it when I tried a case in federal court in Virginia, and Judge Ellis, who's kind of famous, wouldn't let me leave the podium because I kept trying to point to my exhibits and he's like, Ms. Bartram, come up here, you know, and he called me up there and he said, were you a teacher? And I said, well, I am a teacher. And he said, my wife's a teacher. And you just remind me of my wife. Do not use your hands. And he, you know, stomped me back. And I thought, okay, you know what? I am a teacher. And it really helped me, even though he wouldn't let me point to anything.
I've never heard of that rule, not being able to point.
Oh, no. Can't even point. Hands on the lectern in his courtroom.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So So the defense lawyer was getting yelled at too. But anyway, that really helped me. I'm like, you know what? Just be who you are. That's the key, I think. And I think age, getting older, makes you more comfortable, especially, I don't know, I'm not a guy, but for women, I think once you get beyond 50, you're like, you know what? This is cool. And I am who I am. And I like it. And I can be and say exactly what I want. And I've earned that. So I think that helps too, getting a little old.
Well, I've been successful in that part of things, at least. Well, Katie, it's been so great to have you on the
fantastic
podcast. This was a great conversation. Congratulations
on
all of your many successes. I may have to reach out to you offline to run some ideas by you, if you don't mind. And if other folks have listened to the podcast and also want to reach out and connect with you, how would they find you?
My email is probably the easiest. It's Katie, K-A-T-I-E, at blg-dc.com. That's probably the easiest way to find me, as I'm addicted to my iPhone. So I'll definitely get that message. And thank you so much for having me. And Rahul, I wish you the best of luck with your presentation at the Inner Circle. That sounds really awesome. So good luck to you.
Thanks so much, Katie. And it's great spending time with you today.
Yeah. And happy to send anyone the, you know, statutes or anything else they need. I love helping other people. So anybody that reaches out, we'll get you the information.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.